You're listening to a special presentation of the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. On this week's holiday edition, we spend the hour listening to Dennis Edney on the rule of law and the politics of fear. The speech was presented on the evening of June 19, 2015, at the Broadway Disciples United Church in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, in occupied Anishinaabe territory in the homeland of the Métis Nation. Dennis Edney was the lawyer for Omar Khadr, a Canadian who had been held in America's notorious Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for 10 years before being returned to Cuba in 2012. Khadr had been born in Canada in 1986. His father, Ahmed, an Egyptian and Palestinian immigrant, had moved the family back and forth between Canada and Pakistan for years. Following the September 11th attacks, the family had moved to the Pakistani mountains. In early 2002, the 15-year-old Omar had been placed with a group of Arabs in Khost, Afghanistan. In the village of Abu Kail, the house Omar had been staying in came under heavy fire from U.S. forces as part of their invasion of the country, meant to dislodge the Taliban from power. The boy had sustained heavy injuries. However, he was later charged with allegedly throwing a grenade during the firefight that resulted in the death of an American soldier. Dennis Edney first got involved with Khadr in 2003. After a lengthy process, Khadr pled guilty to the charge of murder in violation of the laws of war, attempted murder in violation of the laws of war, conspiracy, two counts of providing material support for terrorism, and spying. This was a plea deal, which would have seen him released to Canadian custody. Omar was brought to Canada September 29, 2012, to serve the remainder of his sentence. On May 7, 2015, Khadr was freed on bail with strict conditions, including living with and under Edney's supervision. On February 18, 2016, the newly elected Liberal federal government dropped the appeal started by the previous Harper government that sought to revoke his bail. In this interview, we'll hear Dennis Edney tell Omar Khadr's story and put it in the wider context of the then Harper government's draconian policies and failure to respect the rule of law. The speech was followed by a brief question and answer period. So here is Dennis Edney on the rule of law and the politics of fear on the Global Research News Hour.
I've been saying to people, you know, I feel like John the Baptist. I've been in the desert for years, and all of a sudden I come home to the village and people are glad to see me. And I was trying to understand that, seriously trying to understand that, because I've been wandering through this desert for quite a long time. I've been fighting every challenge put up against me by this Canadian government, and been successful every time. I'm successful in the US Supreme Court, and but don't run out and hire me, because I lost every pretrial challenge in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But I'm trying to understand why people were so happy about seeing me after all those years was the fact that because I felt lonely for years. You know, when you do a journey like Omar Khadr and you do complicated cases like I do, unless you, it's not easy. And I felt lonely in that journey because, you know, people pass you by. You want the world to believe in what you're doing. You want lawyers who are your colleagues to be knocking on your door saying, "Can I help you?" I want to avoid going to my wife once more for money, and so on and so forth. It's a long-winded way of saying what I realized has happened here is that many, many people in Canada felt that we wouldn't get Omar Khadr out. That you can't defeat power, particularly powerful power in the hands of governments. And the reality is, you can. It may not be easy, it may be slow, but you can. And I've lectured on this for years. I've said to little kids and I've said to students, I'm a powerful guy. And then I used to joke, I used to show my muscles, and the big kids didn't get it. You know, they look at this body and think, forget it. You know, But I'm just giving you a little anecdote tonight before I start, because we are powerful. We are. If we believe in justice, and if we uphold the principles of justice, it's hard to take you down. When you're talking about human dignity, how does someone, unless he's an absolute bigot, argue against you? And the second thing you do then, you do what I do. You make people accountable. You make your politicians accountable. So I better stop talking, because I could take you on a different track tonight than what you're here for. The subject matter of Omar Khadr, as I've said on numerous occasions, is so extensive and complex that my talk this evening can't do it any justice. His story touches from the human to the inhuman, from the legal to the illegal. I could simply sum it up by saying I've never met anybody who has been so abused and so abandoned by so many who should know better. In a few months, Omar will turn 29 years of age, having now spent almost half of his life in conditions that raised international condemnation from human rights organizations, from jurists, from United Nations, and so on, but not by our government. And in my talks, I talk about the right to justice and the entitlement of each and every one of us to protection from inhuman, degrading, abusive treatment, simply because we're human beings. Those principles, I suggest to you, are non-negotiable. It is the core value of a civil society. Yet, it was a memo from the Bush administration that declared that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to allegedly captured terrorists on the battlefield of Afghanistan. The message was loud and clear. The rule of law would not apply to any suspects in the war on terror. And it was that memo that introduced Omar to a life of terror behind the secret walls of Guantanamo Bay. And Guantanamo Bay is simply a place without rules. And it's a place where Omar spent 10 years of his life, where he had been arbitrarily detained, suffered unjust imprisonment, prolonged solitary confinement, torture, and other humiliations. And all the while, our government, through then Foreign Affairs Minister Peter MacKay, persisted in telling each and every one of you here that he has been assured that Omar is being treated humanely and would take the United States at its word, even though every other Western nation had demanded the release of their detainees in Guantanamo Bay, adults, every one of them, and that was granted. International condemnation of Guantanamo Bay in those early days was full of concern about torture. And yet, we are the only government, Western government, never criticized Guantanamo Bay. We simply left a boy, a 15-year-old boy, in hell. The fact that torture has taken place in Guantanamo and that Omar has been subject to different forms of torture during his 10 years in Guantanamo is simply a matter of public record. It's not something I'm making up. And you only have to look no further than a 2008 Supreme Court of Canada decision stating that the United States had violated the International Convention on Torture and the Geneva Conventions with regards to Omar Khadr, and that Canada had also been complicit in his torture. So I say to you, there can be no greater betrayal of Canadian values and our standing in the international community than our government having been implicated in something so utterly horrible as the torture of a Canadian citizen, a youth at that, Omar Khadr. And when that decision came out, it took me 5 years of climbing up to the Supreme Court of Canada, having gathered all kinds of evidence to demonstrate Canada's complicity in Guantanamo. And so, and when the court agreed with my position, the next day I expected a parade outside the house. And there was no public outrage when the decision came out, and there's been very little outrage since. As a matter of fact, when you hear all the questions in the media, not once do they refer back to the 2008 decision that Canada had tortured one of its own. We, each and every one of us, have never made our government accountable for abandoning our constitution, sullying our reputation that others fought hard for. We have all become complicit by our very silence. And history tells us there are some cases that enshrine the defining moments of their time. Omar Khadr's case and the war is one. Future generations will rightly judge our shocking dereliction of responsibility in this matter and our collective failure to extend justice and humanity. And as we, all of us, have failed Omar, we have also failed our children through bequeathing to them an uncertain future as a result of systemic apathy by its citizens and our institutions. I say to you, in my sort of dark view of things, Omar's story, to me anyway, provides a frightening lens into the future of democracy and the decline of the rule of law as we see it. And one has to look no further than the story of Guantanamo Bay to understand how easy it is for a nation to fall into lawlessness. It was in January of 2002 that we, many of us here this evening, these things, witnessed on television the first shocking images of prisoners hooded and shackled for transportation across the Atlantic to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Much as other human beings had been carried in slave ships 400 years ago. And many of those prisoners were described by Human Rights Watch as no more than being farmers and taxi drivers sold by the Northern Alliance to the Americans on the war on terror. And in preparing for that 24-hour trip to Guantanamo, they would be zipped into an orange jumpsuit, hog-chained, meaning they were shackled around their ankles with a waist chain binding their hands to their stomach. And those chains were pulled so tight that many prisoners to this day were still left with the scars. And on the plane, they would be forced into sensory deprivation gear that the US military uses to disorient prisoners prior to interrogation. Opaque goggles covered their eyes, soundproof earphones over their ears and nose, and a mask and a hood over their heads. They were now ready to be bolted, fully trussed, to a backless steel bench or lying prone on the floor of a transport plane for the overseas flight. And I recall Omar telling me about his trip. And he said, "You know, Mr. Redney, 3 days prior to leaving, we were not given any food and only sips of water. And I later discovered this was to ensure that no detainee would require toilet facilities for the long trip to Cuba." Imagine treating your family pet that way. It wouldn't be long before your neighbour came by and you'd be cited for cruelty to animals. And that's exactly how those human beings were believed to be. They were inhuman. And on arrival in Guantanamo, they'd be dumped onto the tarmac of Guantanamo Airport, like so much baggage, to be loaded then into a truck and deposited into wire cages, 6 feet by 6 feet seven, which would be their home for many years, irrespective of the searing heat, the tropical storms. And what we were witnessing was not a manifestation of the Geneva Conventions at work, nor was it an act of deportation or extradition. It was worse. It was far worse. It was the unlawful transportation to a world outside the reach of the law and intended to remain so, and introduced to that life of terror behind those secret walls was a 15-year-old Canadian boy, the only child left in Guantanamo Bay. In fact, I was in New York and I was approached by a representative of Human Rights Watch, and what she said to me was, as I digress, what she said to me was, there were 24 kids in Guantanamo in 2002 picked up and deposited there, and the Bush administration contacted us and asked our assistance in reintegrating these kids back to where they came from. And the only name that wasn't on the table was Omar Khadr. And I asked her why. Why, she thought, why would that be? And she said, well, the message is that Canada doesn't care. The government doesn't care. No one stood up for him. So he was left there. And I should say, however, that Omar's story starts much earlier, for those who are not familiar with it. At the age of 12, his father had moved the Khadr family from Toronto to work in Pakistan and then Afghanistan. And when Afghanistan was invaded by the US, the country was in turmoil. Many sought safety in the mountain regions of Pakistan, including the Khadr family. However, Omar's father abandoned him by leaving him in the hands of a small group of Taliban warriors in a compound, promising to return and pick him up, and he never did. And 6 weeks later, the compound was attacked by US forces. It was bombed and reduced to rubble, and Omar was the only survivor. And when this dust settled, a Delta Force soldier going by the pseudonym of OC1, he gave evidence at Omar's so-called trial, stated he saw Omar crouched on his knees, facing a blank wall, screaming from the bombing and shrapnel that had permanently blinded his left eye. And that soldier then shot him twice in the back. And that action in itself constituted a war crime under international law. And 3 days later, and contrary to all expectations, in fact it was a week later, Omar regained consciousness at the US Naval Base Hospital in Bagram, Afghanistan. And whatever horrors went on in Guantanamo started in Bagram. From the moment Omar gained consciousness, little did he realize that his life had changed forever. Despite the fact that he was suffering from extensive shrapnel wounds to much of his body, that the bones in his left shoulder and chest were shattered from bullet wounds, or that he was now partially blind, he would be taken into an interrogation room with his hands and feet shackled to a stretcher, leaving him unable to resist the horrors that were soon to be penetrated on him. And all the while, pain medication would be withdrawn in preparation for these sessions. And when his interrogators didn't like the answers were given, Omar would then be forced into stress positions. That is, his injured and pained body would be placed into unnatural positions, which caused an agonizing pain in this young boy, screaming and sobbing uncontrollably. It was then that his captors would then take a bright pencil light and shining directly into his damaged eyes, causing even more pain and even more damage that he suffers from today. And Damien Cassetti, one of the torturers who participated in that torture, has publicly stated, "We did terrible things to that boy." And he has reached out to Omar on a number of occasions seeking forgiveness. You know, the interrogation team that committed and perpetrated torture in the hospital in Bagram on Omar and others, you know that team. Many of you may remember the pictures of an American soldier smoking, standing on the naked bodies of Muslim human beings in the Abu Ghraib prison. And that was the team that started off in Bagram and did so well in Bagram that they got promoted to Guantanamo and then from Guantanamo on to Abu Ghraib. And as Omar became, I should tell you more, I should say to you that Sergeant Claus was the leader of this interrogation team. And I may have touched upon it in my talk, but I think it's important to tell you, he was the leader of that team. Damien Cassetti, whom I've met a number of times over the years, when I first met him, he can't stand himself. He was 20 years of age when he was trained to do the interrogations that he did. He can't stand his body. He just shakes all over and his skin feels like it's coming off. And then in the documentary that I'm in called You Don't Wish to Know the Truth, he opens his shirt and he'll show you he's got this big tattoo that says, "I'm a monster." But Sergeant Claus, his leader, was an even greater monster. And I remember dealing with him at the trial in Guantanamo, and he was a hero there, actually. And he was dressed all in black. And he acknowledged that, yes, he may have been a bit more harsh with a young boy than he had been with adults. Think of that kind of human being. It's easier to pick on a child than adults. And as Omar became more mobile, he would be taken into the interrogation room with a black hood placed over his head, intending to disorient him. And Omar described the suffocating feeling he experienced as the hood was wrapped tightly around his neck, nearly choking him. And he would panic, scream out to his interrogators that it was difficult to breathe. And they would just laugh at him, as barking, snarling dogs were then brought in the room to further terrify him. It's all about fear. It's all about humiliation. But more significantly, for me anyway, he would be made to stand on his toes in a crucifix position for hours at a time, with his arms outstretched to the upper parts of a door jamb and hung by the wrists. So eventually, supporting your weight becomes an unbearable strain. And his ankles and feet would swell twice to their size. Moving became agonizing. And while in these positions, this young Omar would urinate on himself. And that was the best time for the team, because he would then be untied and he would use his head as a floor mop to clean up the urine, while at the same time he would be threatened with rape and other humiliating acts, which I don't care to describe any further. You know, I questioned the chief nurse of the Bagram ward that Omar was in, and she said nothing went on there, nothing at all. And then we had a former US Army medic who contacted us and wanted to give evidence at the trial. Of course, he wasn't permitted to be there because Omar had no witnesses at his trial. And he stated that he once found Omar carried chained to the door frame of 5-foot square wire cage with his arms suspended above his shoulders, hood and weeping. Imagine that frightening picture of a 15-year-old boy. Imagine your own child, your own brother, your own sister. It's just unbelievable. It's evil. And another technique would be, it was called the night shift, where Omar would walk up and down the hallways throughout the night carrying buckets of water in each hand. And on reviewing the few medical notes that we were able to get, a nurse noted that his wounds would weep and would seep with blood during this activity. And we're talking about a 15-year-old then. And a former British detainee who was in Guantanamo, and then his government had him released, and whom I interviewed said, "We could hear Omar's cries and moans day and night until we were separated from him. And we all felt bad for him because he was just too young." And I particularly recall the story Omar tells me of the US soldier who would come to his bedside regularly in that hospital. He would then drop his pants, stick his naked bum in Omar's face, and then fart. And people would laugh. Nurses, soldiers would laugh. And so imagine, I've always thought of hospitals as a sacred place, a place where humanity is shown, a place of healing. And we turned that hospital, it was nothing more than an evil place. And I've told you that during this time, Omar's principal interrogator at the Bagram Hospital was Sergeant Joshua Claus. You could check him out. Check him out on the internet. Check him out on Google. He questioned Omar over a 3-month period for up to 6 hours at a time. And Claus later pled guilty to killing killing one detainee in Bagram and crippling two others, using the same techniques that he used on Omar. Except he's a bit rougher on Omar. And in his defense, he said that he felt he pressured to get results. But the government did a deal. He didn't go to prison. The government had him, they gave him immunity so that he could testify at Omar's trial that Omar confessed to him that he had thrown a hand grenade at Sergeant Claus. It's unbelievable, the irony of that. When Omar Khadr was interviewed, gave his press conference, he was asked about, "Did you throw a hand grenade?" And he said, "I don't know." Because he's so truthful. He didn't know. Because from the moment he gained consciousness, and through the years, as they do to each and every detainee, they force the answers that they want. And Omar knew what they wanted eventually, because they told him, you killed Sergeant Claus, you killed Sergeant Claus. To the point, Omar had to acknowledge that, because he knew more pain was coming when he didn't. And Omar described the predominant sound in that hospital ward were the cries of pain from others being abused and tortured. It was just a few days ago that before I came out here, I was on the phone speaking to this human rights organization called CAGE in London, run by former Guantanamo detainees. And I was explaining how Omar was doing. And they then were talking about how they were doing. And they talked about some of their abuses. And, you know, I've been on this road a long time. But I found myself, my eyes welling up, I found I was going to cry. And so I said, "Look, I'll have to call you back." So I say to you, it goes against the very core of humanity that torture and abuse of anyone, let alone a 15-year-old, would take place in a hospital where people are at their most vulnerable. And whatever horrors he experienced in the Bagram hospital followed him to Guantanamo Bay. And they included beatings, humiliation, sleep deprivation, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And I recall my first meeting with Omar, because he had been moved from the cages to one of the secret prisons in Guantanamo. You know of the cages, but we don't publicize that there are three secret prisons in Guantanamo, big concrete prisons, blocks in the desert, which the Pentagon says designed for enhanced interrogation techniques, namely torture. And I won't go on too much about Omar anymore, but I would say to you that when I saw Omar Khadr, I was shocked at the sight of this tragic, lonely figure. He reminded me of a small, broken bird all curled up into himself. And I recall the involuntary gasp at the sight of him, that I had such difficulty in controlling my emotions. I was supposed to be the Adam, I was supposed to be the lawyer, and I wanted to find someone to speak to, someone to hug me, someone to tell me what was going on there. Because I was a father and could not believe what I was seeing. I had young children, and I knew they were in the comfort and safety and security of my wife. And so that first image of Omar haunted me for years. This so very dejected, lonely figure abandoned by all. And every time I left Omar after a visit, I was aware that the fluorescent lights in his cell would remain on 24 hours a day, that he would try to sleep the time away, and that the cold in his cell would prevent sleep, and that incessant lighting had divested him of his feel for night and day. And throughout my numerous years of visiting him in Guantanamo Bay, I never ever saw him walking, as he was always shackled to the floor. I grew up with Omar Khadr sitting on a chair and him sitting on a stool. And he was a young boy, now he's a big, tall man, bigger than myself. You know, in looking at the military dossier records, demonstrate as a result of the unrelenting maltreatment of Guantanamo detainees, there were several hundred suicide attempts. And this, in the documents also stated a high percentage of detainees are on antidepressants. And the report also indicated that at least 100 have become observably mentally ill as opposed to just being depressed. So Omar is often referred by our government as a terrorist who committed a heinous crime, who pleaded guilty to those charges. He does so without any backdrop leading to the plea bargain. The American military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay that convicted Omar was not a normal court. It was a pantomime of justice, removed from the normal American legal system and relying on made-up rules and novel legal interpretations. Some would say a kangaroo court, one worthy of a Middle Eastern dictatorship or a Kafkaesque story. Or as the Alberta Court of Appeal put it recently, in dryly damning language, the legal process under which Khadr was held and the evidence elicited from him have been found to have violated both the Charter and international human rights law. And you know, the Supreme Court of Canada said also as much, which flies in the face of the constant language from our government and from Mr. Blaney, who keeps saying the same two lines without any backdrop. And whatever I'm telling you here, they know. In Guantanamo, every time we had a hearing, officials from the Department of Foreign Affairs were present. I would speak to them. I recall one time saying to an official from Department of Foreign Affairs, if we don't get him out of one of those secret prisons, he's going to die. And she said, I know. And before he pled guilty, he made it clear that he didn't want to do so. He said to me that Canadians would think that he is a terrorist. And I said, not at all. Canada, when they get to see you, hear you, will see a different person. Well, you saw him recently, but in the 2 years he's been here, the Canadian government has fought all the way to make sure you don't get to see him or hear him. And on his return to Canada, he didn't get to see the Canadian public because Mr. Taze, who was a former minister, seems to have a problem reading documents. Because I sent him documents from the Pentagon and from the judge advocate in Guantanamo that expressed that he was nothing more than a good kid. But Mr. Tate's eyesight can't be that good because he read it in a different kind of way. Because he determined that Omar Khadr was a security risk to Canada and to any prisoner in any maximum security prison. And because of that, we located him in Millhaven, where Bernardo and other people were there. And we locked him up for 7.5 months in solitary confinement. And on the day he was released into the prison population, an inmate attempted to stab him and then placed a contract on his life. So I was then able to secure his transfer to a maximum security prison in Edmonton. And on arrival, he was placed on a white supremacist unit, the only Muslim. And within minutes, he was assaulted. And I recall that terrible, terrible day for me. It was the worst day in all my years with Omar. I met a very sad and frightened Omar. Up and until in Guantanamo, he had kept himself together. He'd come back here with hope. And here he was crying to me. And I remember the reality that I faced then, that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't take him out. I couldn't take him home with me. I had to send him back up those stairs, back to those idiots that were waiting for him. In chronicling Omar's ordeal, I'm not simply describing shameful and appalling behavior towards a young Canadian youth that should shock the conscience of all of us, or that he has managed against all odds to maintain an enduring faith in our common humanity, or that his truth has been able to leap prison walls and barriers. It is all of that. It is only by creating a climate of fear that it is easy for people to accept, such as ourselves, that drastic measures must be taken in the interest of security, even if it means the suspension of civil liberties, compromising our values, or ignoring the rule of law. We rationalize it's for the greater good of society. It is then that we fall into lawlessness. So as I conclude, our generation has had the most sophisticated development of international laws, treaties and conventions the international community has ever known, all stating that human rights abuses will not be tolerated. And these international conventions include the Geneva Conventions, the Convention on Torture, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and many, many more, all applicable to Omar Khadr, and all denied him. As a result of the international consensus reflected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Charter of the United Nations, that no one in the future would fall outside the protection of the law has been overridden and supplanted by lawlessness. We only have to look at that hellhole, Guantanamo Bay, that still exists. And as a signatory to all these international treaties, our government has an obligation to protest when they are not being applied to one of its citizens. And not once did it complain to the Americans about its obligations under international law to Omar Khadr. Canada, which is us, which was once viewed as a leader in human rights and upholding the rule of law, is now responsible for undermining those very protections. So Omar's story provides a frightening lens into the future of democracy and the decline of the rule of law as we knew it. Because his story is not just about a young boy who was detained and abused. His story is also about how we as individuals define ourselves as a society and what we are prepared to stand up for. And if this could happen to a 15-year-old Canadian youth, then tell me, assure me, how could any one of us, including our children, ever feel safe? And so I've given you the harsh treatment, the reality. And so I was asked outside a question, had I lost faith? Not at all, ladies and gentlemen, not the slightest. I have seen such humanity from one end of Canada to the other. When I started off, I kind of mumbled about what it all meant about this bail hearing. What this bail hearing meant for Canada was that we can, even a simple guy like myself from Dundee in Edmonton, Alberta, if I can take, and my co-counsel Nate Whitland can take on big governments and be successful, then so can any of you. I was no international lawyer. I'm a former carpenter, former truck driver, lawyer. You know, I'm not sure where I put them all. But I just felt that a situation was imposed upon me that I could not walk away. How could I walk away from that child and live with myself? And it didn't matter whether I won or not. What was important that I took those steps. That's what's important. We stand up and let people know that we stand up for justice. The word justice I use almost like a religious term, even though I'm far from being religious. That's my wife. She complains I don't go to church with her. Justice is a beautiful word because it does away with barriers. It does away with different religious organizations. It does away with color. And what it dresses you in is power. Because how can you take me on? You, Mr. Government, for example. When I'm talking about fundamental principles of humanity, how do you argue against that? You can't. So I thank you very much for listening to me. One other point then is that I have had over 1,000 emails in the last few weeks, with the exception of one email. Everyone says, thank you, Mr. Redney. And the other part is, we feel better as Canadians. I live in this pretty conservative area where most of my neighbours are Jewish, and I think you have to be a doctor to get into the area. And I hardly ever see my neighbours. But you know, since Omar's release, my neighbours have knocked on the door to bring cake, to bring food, to provide flowers, to welcome Omar home. And if you watched the press conference, there were some neighbours shouting at the end of the press conference, welcome Omar. And Omar has been welcomed by all kinds of Canadians. My wife was in West Edmonton Mall and some chap was buying ice cream and he saw Omar and he bought Omar a cone. I was at Omar in Home Hardware and this big bruiser, I don't know how old he was, 50-ish, he looked pretty rough. looked at me with an evil eyes. He went by me, and then he turned around, bypassed me, walked right up to Omar, and said, "You're Omar." He says, "You know, I don't like Americans. I don't like what they did to you, and I wish you the best." So, no matter where he is turned, people are not intrusive, but they want to send a message to him. We're glad you're here. Thank you very much.
My question for you was, do you think that you could have set a draft for a new legal precedent when dealing with alleged terrorists?
Could I have done a what? I'm sorry.
Do you think that you could have set a draft for a new legal precedent when dealing with alleged terrorists?
No.
In this case?
No. It's When you're making a determination, when you're dealing in terrorism, for example, and I've been involved in terrorism for years, the rule of law always applies. It's not a utilitarian analysis of what's best for the many against the rights of the few. That goes against the whole basis of justice. We want to ensure that we send a message to anybody who has committed harm in society that we are human and that we'll provide you with justice, but you, as part of that justice, you very well you need to go to prison. But when they don't follow the law and we don't follow the law, then we're no different.
A question over here.
Sorry, I'm having trouble because unfortunately I read a lot of history, and for almost a decade now I've been using a word that describes exactly the obscenities like Vitave and the other people from the Conservative Party of Canada led by the terrorist of all terrorists, Stephen Harper. I've been using the word fascism and fascist because what has happened in Canada in the last 10 years parallels on so many levels what took place in Germany. As good people, German people are good people, you know. They have families, they have kids, and they did before World War II. And they were good people, but they were apathetic and they were lied to and they were manipulated, just as we have. And yet nobody, I've been taken to task for using the word fascism. But that is the society we live in today. That is the reality we live in today. And I thank you for giving us some of the minute details of one of the aspects of fascism in our country today. And I am so happy you came. Thank you.
Thank you for that. We're in agreement. If one looks at the civil society that was Germany pre-Second World War, I would suggest to you it's far more sophisticated than we were. They had a very, they had a parliamentary system, not the parliamentary system where we have, where there's no debate, where there's omnibus bills no one needs, and we scream and shout at each other. And then we had Then Germany had all kinds of arts and literature and freedom of religion and a powerful police force and so and the judiciary. All those civil institutions we have today. And so I'm not here to give a history lesson, but there is a parallel. And the parallel is apathy is a virus. It's an evil. Unless you stand up and let people know what you stand for, as I earlier said, you stand up for justice, equality, humanity, then we'll have bills like C-51. If we think Bill C-51 is bad, wait till Harper gets elected in the next election. I can't keep track of the bills that have come out, considering the crime rate's gone down for the last 13 years. Thank you very much.
We'll take a question over here next.
Thank you.
So despite the Geneva Convention, time and time again, we've seen the U.S. get away with human rights violations. We saw it with in Vietnam, with their use of chemical warfare in Agent Orange. So my question is, because the U.S. seems to get away with it almost every single time, how do we as Canadians, I guess, how can we mobilize to kind of hold them to account?
We have to hold ourselves to account. I hear this all the time, not what you particular very good question, but I hear what I do. But what you do is, this is your society. Actually, I would tell you, if I were to start again, I wouldn't be speaking to adults. I'd be speaking to kids. I'd be sending them home to talk to their parents to make sure they did something. It's up to us to decide the kind of society we want. You know the kind of society you want. When you're living in your street and your kids are playing outside, you want them to be safe. You want them to have good values. That's the kind of society we are. And when we're not getting it, then we've got to get off our bum and talk to our politicians and talk to our neighbours. And if a politician isn't going to do what we want, then why not have a little hobby of knocking on every door in the neighborhood to say, vote against this guy.
Thank you. Next question over here.
I don't have a question, I just came here to give you a gift. I'm here to recover your... It's a gift of... It's a little medicine drum and a buffalo on it, and a feather. And there's some medicine there, which we believe will protect you on your endeavors from here on in.
Thank you. For the next question.
By chance, I happened to read last year a little book by a Scottish minister, I think it was Church of Scotland. He had spent the 1930s, here in Winnipeg and had been sent by his church to France for the Second World War years, where he acted like the Scarlet Pimpernel and was part of an underground movement to rescue Allied forces that were behind lines and get them back to where they could fight again. And of course, he was caught. And he detailed the tortures that he himself and others went through at the hand of the SS. And the only one that was similar was carrying buckets of water by wounded soldiers and prisoners all night long. And as you described the wounds weeping, it was the same in this book. All the other tortures sound like a picnic next to what you've described here this evening. I'm not shocked, because I did know before, but reassaulted in my senses that this should happen to a child. This should happen to anyone. That we should be complicit in this in any way, shape, or form. And like you said, it's time to knock on doors and get rid of our own little Nazi. Mm-hmm. And take down the rest. It is time we got off our television sets and the internet and stopped playing in our gardens, you know, with our weed killer, and did something before we don't have any land for the Métis, like myself, or the rest of the Aboriginal people, or any of the rest of you, because this is a horrible situation. And I'm sorry it was a statement, not a question. I have 1,000 questions for you, but I just think you're...
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know... one of the things I should say about torture is, contrary to people's beliefs that if one got tortured, that person's going to come after you with a gun, sail across the ocean, climb into your house and shoot you. I heard all that kind of language when I would be in the United States under the Bush administration as I made my way from Edmonton to Guantanamo. I had all the language of fear. The reality of torture of victims, and I admit, unfortunately, quite a few, is that they find a humanity that we don't understand. I was in Argentina and dealing with the chief prosecutor of Buenos Aires, and he's putting up Milford Junta to trial, and during the dirty wars down there, there's a great deal of torture took place. So, you know, I met a Nobel Peace Prize winner who had been tortured. I met all kinds of people who had been tortured, and they say the same thing that Omar Khadr said in Guantanamo, is I never want to see anybody harmed like me, because I remember saying to Omar in Guantanamo years ago, so what do you want to do when I get you out of here? And Omar said, I want to be a doctor. And I said, why? I thought you wanted to be a lawyer. and he said, because I want to make sure that no one is ever harmed. And if you listen closely to his press conference, he made a comment about how he has experienced, played it very quietly, but he said, I've experienced pain. And so the human condition is beautiful and puzzling. How out of hell you can become a better person. I can only give you the example of myself, although my wife may stand up and tell you I'm a bit of a pain to live with and be telling lies. My journey has made me more compassionate, not bitter. My journey has made me feel a better person about myself. I really feel that standing up for someone in the street who falls and helps and picks them up and someone who needs help makes me a better person. And so I have been blessed with the people like yourselves that I've met. People like yourselves have come in here, expressed your feelings, left your house. The human family is beautiful. We don't see it often enough, but it's beautiful. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dennis Edney speaking to an audience at the Broadway Disciples United Church in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on June 19, 2015. You can download this program from the Global Research website. Just go to globalresearch.ca and look under the Global Research NewsHour tab and find it under the heading Dennis Edney, The Rule of Law and the Politics of Fear. For CKUW, this is host and producer Michael Welch. Please stay tuned for your next regularly featured radio program.